This evening we'll be talking on the subject of self-reproducing automata and the origin of life. What we're going to try to do is look at the minimal complexity needed for life by assuming that the simplest living thing is a machine, an automaton, machine owned by itself, that is self-reproducing, makes copies of it. We're going to look at the work of several mathematicians who have done work in this area, von Neumann, a fellow named Codd, and another named Langton, who have designed mathematical models for such machines, and then look particularly at Langton's very simple self-reproducing automaton. We're going to try and suggest that even his automaton, though it is very simple in certain ways, is still sufficiently complex to suggest that life is designed rather than accidental. Well, at this point, then, I'll take up reading, as I say, the paper you have in front of you, more or less, and stopping to explain things now and again when that would seem to need some explanation. In recent decades, a number of scientists have been active seeking to demonstrate that life arose from inanimate matter by purely natural processes. Most of their work has involved studying the biochemistry of simple life forms to propose steps by which the necessary level of complexity could be reached by chemical reactions, whether these be of greater or lesser likelihood. To facilitate such proposals, various assumptions have been made about the nature of the Earth's early atmosphere, generally going to the reducing atmosphere because these are more open to producing, allowing formation of amino acids and nucleotide bases and such, which are the building blocks out of which protein and nucleic acid combinations, RNA and DNA, are made. About the energy sources necessary to drive these needed reactions, typically ultraviolet light from the sun, possibly electrical discharges in connection with storms, and occasionally volcanic heat. About specialized environments in which inorganic chemicals might be converted to simple organics such as sugars, amino acids, and nucleotides. Some work has also been done in seeking to polymerize such simple chemicals to produce the very complex biopolymers such as proteins and nucleic acids, DNA and RNA, which are crucial biochemicals of living cells. Results to date have not been particularly persuasive, though obviously for persons who believe that that's something like that had to happen, that there's no God out there to do it, that's what they've got. And we'll often argue, well, our view is scientific, that is, doesn't depend upon any supernatural agency. I don't think that's a great definition of science, not depending on supernatural agency, but it's not the thing we want to discuss tonight. The great complexity of biopolymers, such as DNA, proteins, has made it almost impossible to believe that present-day life chemistry could really have been produced by purely natural processes. The jump in complexity from simple organics of a half dozen or so atoms in a molecule to such biopolymers, which sometimes have many, many thousands or even millions of atoms in a single molecule, is just too large to be explained by purely random process. In response to this, those who believe in a naturalistic origin of life claim that some much smaller molecules must exist which are capable of self-reproduction, and that only these were formed by random processes. Such molecules then evolved by mutation and natural selection, a process which is invoked again and again as a powerful way of producing order in an otherwise random situation, to the large complex proteins and nucleic acids used in life today. These smaller molecules were eventually rendered obsolete by their more complex descendants and so passed off the scene. Therefore, we don't see them. Okay? In this paper, we do not intend to examine this claim directly by a discussion of biochemistry. For one thing, I don't know enough biochemistry. Instead, we wish to investigate the mathematical complexity of self-reproduction. What is the structure, the minimal structure needed for something to make a copy of itself? At least for those who believe in the naturalistic origin of life, a definition of a living thing as a self-reproducing machine should be satisfactory, even if Christians may wonder whether such a definition might not be too simple. What then can we find out mathematically about the simplest structure that can reproduce itself? How complex is such a structure? What is the likelihood that such a structure might have formed randomly in the available time and space our universe provides. These questions lead us to the mathematical theory of self-reproducing automata. Judging from the literature, the first person to design a mathematically feasible machine which reproduces itself was John von Neumann, born 1903, died 1957. Native of Hungary, von Neumann came to the U.S. in 1930 after earning his doctorate in mathematics at the University of Budapest. In 1931, he became a professor at Princeton University, and 2 years later, a member of the Institute for Advanced Study there, perhaps best known as where Einstein did most of his work. Von Neumann was unusual among mathematicians in being interested in applications of all sorts and in being able to communicate easily with scientists and engineers. During World War II, he was active in military applications of mathematics and later served on the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission. Although von Neumann invented the mathematical theory of games and made important contributions to both ergodic theory, study of apparently random behavior of molecules, and how certain things such as pressure and temperature arise from their behavior, and the mathematical theory foundations of quantum mechanics, we're here interested in his pioneering work in computers, which eventually led to his mathematical theory of self-reproducing automata. Von Neumann got into computers through the problem of solving what we call nonlinear partial differential equations. Here he came to realize that mathematics had reached a stalemate in trying to obtain general solutions to such equations, but that specific cases could be solved numerically. For certain types of mathematics, you can write down an equation that's a solution to the problem, but for this whole range of what we call partial differential equations, particularly nonlinear ones, you frequently can't write down anything like that. I'm not sure whether it's impossible, but nobody's found it. That's kind of where you're at. So what you wind up is you solve individual problems numerically and then try to figure out how to generalize them. These solutions could then be used as a guide to theorizing about general solutions. Since numerical solutions to such equations are quite time-consuming when done by hand, von Neumann got involved in early work on electronic computers. He was consultant on several early models called ENIAC, EDVAC, JohnnyAC, suggesting improvements in their physical design and memory. He also invented the idea of using flowcharts for program design, just floated over to other areas as well, and pioneered the concept of using one language for the computer and another for the programmer, that he programmed in that would translate between the two languages. In working out a theory for automatic control of computers by internal programs, he was led to a mathematical theory of automata. In all, von Neumann produced 5 works on automata. First of all, his general and logical theory of automata, written in 1948, but not published until 1951. Secondly, his theory and organization of complicated automata, 5 lectures given in 1949. Third, his probabilistic logics and the synthesis of reliable organisms from unreliable parts, 1952. That is a very interesting article on how you can make a machine that is almost infallible, even though all of its parts are fallible. Rather interesting suggestion. It's not infallible, of course, but it's astronomically less likely to make a mistake than any of its parts are. Fourth, his theory of automata, construction, reproduction, homogeneity, written in 1952 and 3. And fifthly, his book, The Computer and the Brain, written in 1955-6 and published after his death in 1958. Items 1 and 3 are now available in Volume 5 of von Neumann's collected works. Item 5, as I mentioned, was published as a separate book, and items 2 and 4, in which we are especially interested, were published posthumously as the theory of self-reproducing automata. Though von Neumann intended eventually to design a mathematical model of reproduction that would realistically simulate a simple living organism, he only lived long enough to sketch out details for a much more abstract automaton that would make a copy of itself. This automaton was completed with a few minor corrections by Arthur Burks. Let's look briefly at von Neumann's automaton as a preparation for a further discussion of much simpler automaton. Von Neumann imagined his self-reproducing automaton as an organized collection of small automata which we can represent as individual computer chips filling a large two-dimensional plane. These chips are rectangular, and linked to each of their four nearest neighbors. Each chip can be in any one of 29 different states, which include a quiescent or turned-off state, several warm-up states for converting the quiescent state into functional states, and finally several functional states, which would transmit information in various directions or serve as junctions for information transmission. Von Neumann's self-reproducing automaton consisted of imposing certain initial state values on a set of chips at time t equals zero in such a way that this set of chips would subsequently send out a construction arm, that is, convert a bunch of quiescent chips to chips that represent a construction arm, and convert a quiescent set of chips nearby into a copy of itself. This automaton was rather complex, involving an array of some 300 by 500 chips for the memory control unit, something similar for the construction unit, and a tail of some 150,000 chips to store information on the details of the automaton that we built. I have a little sketch of the idea here. The idea is that you have a rather complicated automaton called a universal constructor that will make a copy, given these things, a copy of by converting computer chips into turned-on states of various sorts, of anything that the information tail out here told it to make. And it would send out a constructing arm and make this other thing over here. And what you do is the information you put in this tail is the information needed to construct something just like this. So it puts out an arm, constructs something like this, and then it constructs a tail to go with it, and then it turns it on. And it has made a copy of itself and pulls the arm back. And this one out here then puts out an arm and constructs a copy of itself and puts on the right kind of tail and pulls back its arm and turns that one on, but turns it on first and pulls back the arm. And then that one goes on ahead. So that's the idea. Von Neumann's self-reproducing automaton is notable, like early computers, mainly for showing that such a machine is feasible. Its enormous complexity, however, hardly gives encouragement to those who hope that a self-reproducing machine might happen by itself. I give you one little picture here from von Neumann's book of a part of the tape unit and its reader as well. And again, we're still talking big, large pieces without the details spelled out on how all the individual chips work and such here. He spelled out a fair amount of the details in the book. This would be the tail out here and the device for going out and reading a particular chip in it and sending information back to the control unit here. In the years since von Neumann's proposal, various attempts have been made to simplify his automaton. E.F. Codd, for instance, was able to design an automaton in which each of the constituent computer chips needed only 8 states instead of von Neumann's 29. Yet Codd's automaton was still as complex as a typical electronic computer, hardly likely to happen by chance. Recently, Christopher Langton has proposed a drastic simplification of von Neumann's automaton, following up on some ideas suggested by Codd. Langton notes that the automata of von Neumann and Codd were unnecessarily complex because each was designed to be able to make any kind of automaton, depending on the information stored in the machine's long tail. Thus, each made copies themselves as a special case of their capabilities as universal constructors. Langton notes that nothing so complicated as this is necessary, since the living things we're trying to mimic only make copies themselves, not of some drastically different life forms within some boundaries, such as the problem of butterflies making caterpillars and such, where there's some fairly drastic changes that take place along the line. Langton thus abandons the idea that the automaton be able to make other kinds of automata, and seeks a simplest machine which will make only copy itself. In what follows, let us go into some detail in order to appreciate Langton's simple self-reproducing automaton. Following Codd, Langton represents the array of computer chips mathematically as a two-dimensional array of numbers, one for each chip, which numbers specify the state in which each chip is presently functioning. So if 6 at a certain place means this chip is in state 6. And if in the next step of your process that turns into a 3 or an 0 or something, it means that chip has changed to the other location. This basically means mathematically that these can be stored and manipulated as what we call a matrix, a array of numbers, which computers are rather nice at handling. Following COD, Langton represents the array of computer chips mathematically as a two-dimensional array of numbers, one for each chip, which specify the state in which each chip is present to function. Zero is used to represent the chip in its quiescent state. It's basically turned off or idling. And numbers 1 through 7 represent the other functional states. The automaton can thus be represented mathematically as a two-dimensional matrix of numbers, which change with each unit of time as the machine functions. Again, simplification. Instead of having the machines operate continuously like our machines do, they operate by units of time. The chips are all in this particular set of states at time t, and one unit later, suddenly they're in this state, maybe slightly different, maybe a lot different. And then time t plus 2, they're in another state, etc., with rules telling how you get from each state to each next state. The state of a particular chip at time t is calculated from its own state at the previous time step t minus 1, as well as the states of its neighbors at t minus 1. So you're interested in what the chip's own value was and what the value of its four neighbors that are horizontal or vertically connected. No angle stuff here. It's kind of like certain chess players that only move in right angles. They don't move at the diagonals. Okay. So it only gets information from the four chips that are above, below, and left and right. And it uses that information and its own value to figure out what value eventually, one will work out a transition function table, given that this is the value of the chip at a particular time, and this is the value of the four neighbors. Here's what the new value of that chip will be at time equals 1, the next time step. I showed you the chart in the article. You can see it's fairly complicated. It fills a whole page with small numbers. Basically, the CTRVL represent the value of the central chip, the chip you're interested in, the chip above it, the top chip, the chip to the right, the chip to the bottom, and the chip to the left. Okay, and those that particular value gives you a value which we call I, which is the central chip's value at the next time step. So if you have all the chips in state 0, say top left-hand one there is, the central chip will be 0 next time, and next time, and next time, and next time, et cetera. Something's got to move into its area and start changing some chip values. Whereas on the other hand, if we go down here and pick the last one down here in the below right, if the initial value of the central chip is 7, and the top chip is 0, and the right chip is 2, and the bottom chip is 7, and the left chip is 2, that chip will be in state 0 next time step. Okay? Now he has to work all these out so the thing will do what he wants it to do. So this is rather crucial in the whole setup, but we'll come back to discuss that in just a minute. Let me go back to that paper at this point. What the 7 functional states of the chip actually do in the machine can be chosen by the designer as he selects the set of transition rules which govern how each state changes with time. Following COD, Langton defines state 1 as an element of a data path. 0 is quiescent. 1 is an element of a data path. State 2 is used for elements of sheath material which protect the data path. Here, COD and Langton are looking at the idea of how nerves work, where they've got a center that carries the information and a sheath on the top and bottom, actually all the way around, but we're two dimensions, so we don't have to go all the way around, instead of above and below, that protect the data path. States 1 and 2 work somewhat like a nerve cell, which has a central core transmitting its signal, protected by sheath to keep the signal from straying, or like an insulated electric wire. Ones would be the copper wire, and the twos would be the plastic insulation. Figure 1 there on your paper, if you've got in front of you, would show a data train, part of a data train, obviously. It's got to have something more to it to be functional with the insulation, if you like, on the outside. The remaining numbers are now down to 3 through 7. Give us 5 signals, which can be defined to tell the automaton to carry out various functions. Typically, these signals will move along a data path of ones. The direction of movement of a signal is specified by making each signal a pair of digits, the leading digit being one of the numbers 3 through 7, the following digit of 0. Figure 2 shows a 7 signal, which will move to the right one step for each unit of time. So the 7 there with the 0 behind it, and the 0 behind it means it's moving to the right. We see a particular time here. The next time, the 0 and the 7 would be moved over 1, and there would be a 1 replacing the 0 and 7. Data paths form junctions where a path splits in two, or if you like it better, where two paths run into each other. That is the direction. Figure 3 here then shows a bunch of 1s and a set of 1s then branching off from that going upward from the horizontal, and these then surrounded by sheaves. When a signal approaches such a junction, coming, say, from the left, it will split into two copies of the signal, one following each of the other data paths. Notice in figure 4 how the 7 is coming in from the left. Time t is just about the junction at time t plus 1. It's at the junction. Time t plus 2, it's now a 7 continuing to right out of the junction, and another one starting up, and the next step, there'll be a 0 right behind the 7 in both places, and a 1 will come to the junction and such. Given these features, we can design a simple device which will send a periodically repeating signal along a data path. We simply make a closed loop with an open tail in one corner, as we see in figure 5. What happens here then is that, I'll tell you here on this page, the device shown will continually circulate its 7-0 signal counterclockwise around the small loop or square, if you prefer to call it that. But sending a 7-0 signal down the path to the right once every time the signal in the loop comes around the junction at the lower left corner. So if you're sitting out somewhere down this path to the right, every few units of time, a 7-0 signal will come at you from inside this loop, but it'll keep a copy of itself floating around inside the loop, okay? All this was noted by Codd. It was the genius of Langton to observe that in this one simple device, we already have the makings of a self-reproducing machine without adding a lot of additional complexity. Suppose the 7-0 signal was so defined that when it strikes the end of a data path, that is a set of 1s capped off on the end by a 2, it lengthens a data path by 1 unit. Figure 6 shows how this happens. As the 7 comes down towards the end, hits the end, turns the end into a 1, and then by properly designing the transition rules, that makes a new set of 2s around the outside of it, so it makes the end of the data path 1 longer. Now suppose the 4-0 signal is so defined that a pair of such signals, 2-0 signals, striking the end of the data path causes the path to make a left-hand corner. There's not enough to have it make either a right-hand corner for one set of signals and a left for the other one of the signals, so Codd chose to have it make a left-hand turn. You could make a new set of transition rules where you have things that make right-hand turns, but here they all make left-hand turns. It turns out that we need to use another state, say 3, as an intermediate step in this maneuver, leaving us with just 2 states, 5 and 6, for anything else we want to do. At this point, we have the machinery necessary to send a repeating signal around a loop of the proper size, such that the signal can extend the loop's arm or tail, whatever you want to call it, in units, and then make the arm turn left. If we have a signal go around the loop 4 times, it will make the arm fold itself around into another loop. You extend the thing, turn left, extend the thing, turn left, extend the thing, turn left, until you come back and collide with the original thing. You've made yourself an extra loop out here. With some judicious choices of the transition rules, remember these govern how a chip changes state at the next time step on the basis of its previous state and the state of its 4 neighbors, we can design the 2 remaining signals, 5 and 6, to arise when a signal going around a new loop collides with a signal coming from the old loop. The 5 and 6 are designed to move away from the collision area in opposite directions. The 5 disconnects the daughter loop from the mother and causes the mother to form a new arm at the next corner counterclockwise from the original arm, where it will then begin the process of forming another daughter loop. The 6 makes a new arm on the daughter loop so that it can begin to form a granddaughter. Doubtless it took Langton a lot of experimenting to find the simplest such machine that worked. But he eventually came up with a loop 10 units on the side. possessing a 5-unit arm and storing its construction information in a sequence of 6 7-0 signals followed by 2 4-0 signals. The machine, with the signals properly located at time t equals 0, which you've got in your figure 7 of your paper, will first extend its arm 6 units and then make a left corner. By then, the information will have cycled around the loop once more and come back again, extending the arm in a new direction 6 units and turning it left again. In 35 time units, the arm turns its first corner, at 70, its second, at 105, its third corner. The new loop closes back on itself at t equals 124, separates into 2 loops, don't have that shown in my picture here, at t equals 128, sets up the mother loop to start making another daughter, but now off in this other direction, at t equals 147, and has the first daughter in the same state as the mother originally was at t equals 0, at t equals 151. Having programmed my small personal computer in the basic language to apply Langton's transition rules to his initial loop, I can testify that it works. Due to limited memory space and a slower computer, I did not run the program past t equals 153 to see the birth of the third and fourth generation loops as Langton did. My machine took about a minute per step. And so at 153, which is what, 2.5 hours, I wasn't about to run 5 or 6 generations. I was also running 1 page of paper per step. Did not want to run through several reams of paper. Due to limited memory space and a slower computer, I did not run the program past t equals 153 to see the birth of third and fourth generations, as Langton did. He provides an interesting discussion of how the loops die when they run out of space to make further daughters. Picture that here somewhere. Not a great picture. He provides an interesting discussion of how the loops die when they run out of space to make further daughters, for which I refer you to his original program. This one, the diagram of the original program, shows you something. Here's the original loop over here, now reduced to just a little line drawing. It makes a daughter to the right of it here. This is the daughter over here. And then turns around and puts its new arm up here, upward, whereas the daughter is still pointing, is now pointing to the right. And it makes another daughter up there. That daughter will be this one here. And then the daughter, a granddaughter over here, and this is the original mother. It now turns and starts making one in this direction, and I will probably get lost at that point. I guess that's this one here. This is the original mother here. And finally, when it turns around to face the same way it did before, it runs into an existing machine there, and so that makes it pull its arm back and it kills it. It happens that the way you set up the thing, all of that will happen kind of automatically. So you begin to develop some dead cells in the middle and new cells growing out on the outside. Looks a little bit like the way a tree behaves or something of that sort. And he traces no one for out to about 7 generations. He's obviously got a more expensive computer than I do or more patience, I don't know which. So here we see his design as it gets further and further out. A copy of my program with transition rules and starting loop is provided in the index to this paper, should you wish to adapt it to your computer and experiment with it yourself. It's much more sophisticated than the public domain computer game called Life. One thing I've been doing with it, which I don't mention in this paper, is experimenting with causing mutations in the thing and seeing how they work. And I really had to work hard to find any mutation that actually functioned. Most of them killed the thing very quickly. By studying the machine itself, I could find some intermediate steps in the state of the machine, which I could then mutate into the thing at other places and get it to do those, so I could get it to put on another arm at an earlier stage and some things like that. So, Langton has brilliantly demonstrated that something mimicking life can be designed. Does this indicate that life arose by chance or by design? To get some feel for the answer to this question, we need to analyze the complexity of his automaton. Clearly, Langton's device is at or near the minimum complexity for self-reproduction of any meaningful sort. The information stored in the data train is very small because of the loop's four-sided symmetry. That is, it only has to tell it how to extend and how to turn. It doesn't have to tell it anything more, and because it can repeat that 4 times, you can actually get this loop. So it's making extremely, extremely efficient use of a very small amount of information. Even so, To specify the particular initial state of the automaton, we must indicate the state of n chips at t equals 0. Thinking the automaton as a rectangular array of 10 by 15 chips, n would equal 150. But we can ignore chips outside the structure itself and make n equals 110. We can ignore the chips inside the donut hole of the loop and get down to n equals 94. Or finally, we can ignore all the zero state chips and get the n down to 86. For each case but the last, each chip specified could be in any one of eight states, giving 8 to the nth power combinations. For the last, each could be in any one of 7, giving 7 to the nth power combinations. Table 1 below, in its middle column, gives a number n of possible combinations by which chips could be specified in each case. Thus, to produce the complexity, the initial state of the Lankin automaton, we go with n as 86, the lowest number we can get here. You then need to search through 5 times 10 to the 72nd power combinations for the one which works. Allowing for the 4 rotations through 90 degrees, you can divide that by 4, but you still have about 10 to the 72nd combinations. But before we attempt to estimate how likely the random formation of such a functional automaton is, we should note that most of the complexity of this device has been hidden under the rug, so to speak, in the details of transition rules. I already showed you the overhead with nearly a page of figures on how to get the transition rules. They are not in the structure. They're in this information on how to tell the thing that this chip with these neighbors changes to this chip, something the computer stores. These rules can be simplified slightly from those listed in Lankin's Table 1 by eliminating all rules which put this chip in state 0 and specifying instead that all rules not listed give a 0 result. Even doing this, there are 190 rules producing the other 7 states. To produce these randomly, we would need to search 7 to the 190th combinations, or about 2 times 10 to the 160th. Combining this with the complexity of the initial state calculated above, we obtain the results n prime in the right-hand column of Table 1 above, and again jumping down to n equals 86, and allowing for rotations, which divides the result by about 4, we have about 5 times 10 to the 232nd combinations. The number of combinations listed for the easiest case corresponds to the number of 276-letter words, where 276 is the sum of 86, the number of chips, plus 190, the number of rules, that one can make with a 7-letter alphabet. How likely is it that such a number of combinations would be successfully searched in the history of the universe? To make such a calculation, we have to make some assumptions concerning how many objects are being searched and how rapidly they're being searched. Since it's the biochemical situation to which we want to eventually apply a result, let us try to mimic this in a very rough way. Emphasis, very rough. Let us suppose that the 7 letters correspond to 7 common elements occurring in life chemicals, and the words correspond to strange molecules formed by their combinations. Please be advised that we're not doing any real chemistry. Let us take hydrogen as state 0 and leave it out of the calculation. Let's ignore helium as unreactive and call the 7 elements carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, sulfur, phosphorus, potassium, and sodium. This calculation is going to be very sloppy, so let's give each element the same abundance, namely that of carbon, the most common of the 7, which has an abundance of about, it looks like about 3/10,000ths that of hydrogen, if I read my decimals right. Suppose all these elements within a given volume of the universe are forming only 276 element chains, and that they're forming new combinations as rapidly as a carbon atom can move to a new chain, say a distance of about 10 angstroms at standard temperature, say 300 degrees Kelvin. Need I point out that all of these assumptions are fantastically favorable to this working out. Then using Boltzmann's equation to calculate the speed of carbon atoms at 300 degrees Kelvin, we get 3 times 10 to the 4th centimeters per second. New chains will form at the rate of rate equals 8 times 10 to the 11th per second per chain. Speed, distance they've got to cover. In the visible universe, or actually the universe out to the Hubble radius, somewhat beyond where we can see a thing, there are about 2 times 10 to the 12th galaxies, averaging 10 to the 11th stars each. Taking our sun as an average star, it has a mass of 2 times 10 to the 33rd grams. This amounts to about 4 times 10 to the 56th grams of hydrogen within the Hubble radius. Assuming each of the 7 elements being used is as common as carbon, the mass of elements reacting is about 8 times 10 to the 53 grams. Using Avogadro's number and an average gram atomic weight for elements 24, this will give about 2 times 10 to the 76 atoms reacting in our chains, or dividing by the number of atoms per chain, 276, about 7 times 10 to the 73rd chains. The time to form the total number of possible combinations is then time equals number of combinations over number of chains times rate per chain. And I put in all the numbers for that, and we wind up with a time of 3 times 10 to the 139th years. This is a long time. We can easily convert this into a probability that this will happen in our universe in its 20 billion year history merely by dividing the age of the universe by the time given above. The result is probability 10 to the minus 129. Needless to say, this probability is astronomically small. They're estimated to be about only 10 to the 81st elementary particles in the universe. Suppose one of these particles were marked, and we were set the task of randomly selecting this particle from all the others in the universe with no way of telling it from the others. The chance of successfully locating such a particle would be 10 to the 48 times larger than the chance formation of a molecule with the organized complexity of the Langton automaton. It seems to me that one who believes life arose by natural processes can only make 2 responses to this. First, maybe life is designed after all. This has been the response of several formerly agnostic scientists recently. 2, perhaps the simplest self-replicating machine is really much simpler than the one we have analyzed. To which I respond, please design some such machine so that we can take your answer seriously. It does not look like the machine we designed can be simplified beyond where we are now. That, I think, is the real problem. Richard Dawkins, author of a rather well-known book called Selfish Gene, in another of his books, The Blind Watchmaker, believes that we should choose a naturalistic model for the origin of life, even if the model predicts it is very unlikely to happen. He suggests that since there may be as many as 10 to the 20th Earth-like planets in the universe, 10 to the 20th, let's see, 10 to the 9th is a billion, so that's 100 billion billion Earth-like planets in the universe, and since it took about 1 billion years for life to show up on Earth, we should admit any model in which the formation of life on a given Earth-like planet has a probability of only 1 in 10 to the 20th. According to our calculations here, the probability of forming a single self-replicating molecule is more than 10 to the 100th power less than Dawkins' threshold. It seems to me that we're looking at very strong evidence that life is designed. I respond to any questions you might have. We have plowed very quickly through some stuff that isn't that bad if you sit down and work with it for a while, but it's messy if you haven't. So, yes. Sure. Basically, what I've done with mutations is do little things to the initial state. You could, in principle, do it somewhere else along the line. Do little things to the initial state, like replace a 2 with a 1 or a 1 with a 0, or put a little pimple out on it or an abscess out on the edge of the thing. I found, I've not tried a lot of samples. I think I've probably tried about 17 samples, that all but one of them kill the thing within perhaps 20 to 40 time steps, something like that. I start at the initial step when there aren't any daughters, okay, and I start to make one. And what typically happens is that the thing messes up the data train in some way, so that it begins to eat up the data train. It is possible you might be able to get around that by jiggling with the transition rules. Maybe the transition rules make the thing a little too fragile. I don't know. My suspicion is that if you jiggle with the transition rule so it's not so fragile, it begins to start putting off all sorts of hairy pieces to it and such, and goes to pieces in that way. But I haven't tried that yet. But all I've done so far is do things like change a 0 to a 1 or a 2 to a 3 or something like that. I've tried a bunch of different ones at different places on it, and it rather consistently messes the thing up. The only thing I was able to do was watch how the thing, after making the daughter, pulls back its arm and sends a signal up one side to make a new arm, etc. And it depended upon a 5 running up the outside edge of one of the sheaths. And I said, well, suppose I, on the starting thing, I put a 5 in the sheath right over here. And I messed around, and I find out that most of the places I put it still wrecked the thing. But there was one place you could put it, that is, that the 5 was just at the right place with a certain part of the data train going by, that would come down and put a new arm out. So you could get the thing to put a second arm out a few steps after the original first arm, which was there to start. And presumably it would start making 2 things here and then make another pair here and would die off in 2 steps instead of 4, but would survive to make daughters and they would go ahead. So that was the only mutation I could find. There doubtless are more. That was the only one I could find that worked with the particular thing. That suggests then that for a naturalistic origin of life, you probably need something significantly more complicated than this, because this is very fragile in its simplicity. And you need something that, thought dropped out of my mind there. You need certainly something that's significantly more complicated than this to make it run. And it seemed to me that you would need something that that would be able to tolerate slight varieties without going to pieces. And my guess is if you've got something that does that, that's more complicated too. It's got some kind of an error repairing or ignoring mechanism in it. this article by von Neumann on making reliable machines out of unreliable parts shows how if you've got things where you compare the results from several things at each step along the line, you can protect against error in one part of the scheme by having it outvoted by no error in the others. He shows how you can make a calculator that will make a mistake once every 1,000 calculations. And that, of course, would be rather disastrous if you're using that calculator to calculate numbers that are 3,000 digits long, because you pretty well guarantee a couple of errors before you got through the calculation. How do you solve that? Well, you have 2 or 3 of these working in parallel, 2, 3, or 4 of these working in parallel, and at each step they compare the result, and you throw out the divergent result every step. Then you can run up the complexity of the thing from 1 in 1,000 to 3 of them. You get that cubed, I think. So 1 in 1 billion, etc. So you can do calculations with nearly 1 billion digits and not make any mistakes. And so perhaps you could design an automaton that would have duplicating features that would check each other out, and so a mutation wouldn't mess things up. But notice what happens there. The mutation would be ignored. And in this scheme, thrown out even. Okay, so it still doesn't mutate anything. That just drastically reduces how the mutation goes. You've got to instead have a machine in which the mutation is kept and perhaps is usable further on, but it doesn't mess the thing up at the present state. That looks to me like you're getting to something much more complicated. It may be that there's some way to make it work out there by chance. I'm very skeptical. That's what I would say. Further comments, questions, I'm sorry. John Ronnie is doing. So far, all computer modeling. This one, in principle, could be built without too much trouble. You'd have to design a little chip circuit that could be in one of these states. I'm not sure how you tell the thing to use these rules. It sounds like each of the chips would have to have the information of these transition rules. It's a more complicated chip, okay? Still very simple compared with the typical chips you've got in computers now. But that means the substratum that you're starting to work with, well, what would happen is we put that complexity in there, okay? We did calculate that complexity in our calculation, though. So, so that's not fair to cheat on that. Okay. No, I haven't. I've modeled this one. You know, model on a computer easily. In principle, this would work okay, I would think. You would have to go to some trouble of designing a chip. They would all be identical once you put them together. They'd have to all be wired and such. But should be able to work. Nobody ever tried von Neumann's because a 29-state chip and then needing to have several 100,000 of them to put the thing together is outrageous. This, I used a matrix 40 by 40 and didn't need that much. I just wanted something I thought would fit in the memory when the thing operated. Praise the Lord, it did fit in the memory, okay, and was able to do this. He's obviously used something much bigger so he could get seven generations scattered all over. This must be a much, much larger matrix, maybe 1,000 by 1,000 or something. So, yeah, as far as I know, nobody has tried to build one. I'm afraid it would be financially pretty rough going compared to modeling it on a computer, which is pretty cheap, once you know, very easy once you've got the computer. So, no. Yeah, further questions, comments? Thank you all for coming.